puts me back in Manitoba many moons ago.
I have missed that music and I've been looking forward to this conversation. Is it really a Sunday morning if we don't have Abandoned Manitoba on? Gordon Goldsborough joins me now. Good morning, Gordon.
Good morning, Nadia. Welcome back.
Thank you so much. Lovely to be here. Lovely to see you again. What are we talking about?
We're going to talk about a group related to Manitoba history that I suspect most of our listeners have never heard of. The group was established by the provincial government 77 years ago and was called the Historic Sites Advisory Board of Manitoba, and it still exists today.
Okay, I don't think I've ever heard of it, to be honest.
No, the group is virtually unknown outside of a few civil servants and members of Manitoba's heritage community. The Historic Sites Advisory Board came about as a result of provincial legislation that is referred to as, quote, the Historic Sites Preservation Act. It was passed in 1946 with the goal to protect land, buildings, structures, or movable objects from being, and this is a quote from the act, examined, investigated, surveyed, excavated, destroyed, moved, exported, or taken from the province without permission of the Minister of Health and Public Welfare. The board was essentially a public group that would advise the minister on subjects coming under the provisions of the act.
I feel like you would have been on this board.
Perhaps if I had been born a lot earlier than I was, yeah.
So who was on the advisory board?
Well, it prescribed a 7-person board, and as was typical for the time, all 7 were white men. Although they did come from a rather curious range of backgrounds, the chair of the board was the principal of United College. That's today's University of Winnipeg. He was a professor of Old Testament languages and literature. Ooh, very solid. The vice chair was a geologist at the University of Manitoba. Rounding out the board were a science teacher who later became director of the Manitoba Museum, a Winnipeg physician, a farmer and naturalist, an employee of the Hudson's Bay Company who served as editor of its magazine, The Beaver, and a Roman Catholic priest. One of the board's first meetings was held to identify historic sites that should be officially designated as such by the province. It was essentially the first provincially designated historic sites in Manitoba's history.
So they're all provincially designated, these historic sites?
Yes. Now, there was already a national group called the Historic Sites and Monuments Board of Canada. It had been founded back in 1919 to identify nationally significant places across the nation. But there were many more sites within Manitoba whose significance didn't rise to the level warranting national recognition, but which were nevertheless important. These were the ones that drew the attention of the Historic Sites Advisory Board, and the board named its first set of 5 sites in May of 1948.
And what were they?
The first was a fur trade post of the Northwest Company, known as Fort Panansa-Wewinning. It was established in 1802 by European explorer Alexander Henry the Younger. The fort had been located a short distance southwest of present-day Morden. Panansa-Wewinning, by the way, was an indigenous word that I'm told means on the way to the River Ford, probably a description of the fort's location near Dead Horse Creek. A couple of 100 meters from the former fort site was the second designated site, an indigenous burial mound called at that time the Weeb Mound.
And where were the other 3 original historic sites located?
Well, 2 were near Arden, east of Neepawa. 1 was an indigenous campsite and burial mound on the north side of town. The other was another burial mound southwest of Arden. And the 5th and final site was a short distance northwest of Brandon. It was another indigenous burial mound and campsite. So, of the 5 initial historic sites, 4 related to indigenous history and the 5th to fur traders.
And are these original 5 historic sites all still designated today?
No, that's interesting. Only 2 of them. Neither of the sites near Morden have provincial designation today, nor does 1 of the sites at Arden. Only the indigenous campsites near Arden and Brandon are still provincial historic sites.
And did the advisory board name more historic sites beyond these original five?
They did. You know, there was an initial sort of spate of activity soon after it was established in 1946. But the Historic Sites Advisory Board became much less active over the ensuing years. For example, in 1948, it had just one meeting. And in 1949, again, just one meeting. But then it didn't meet again until 1952, 3 years later. In fact, it wasn't until the late 1950s, you know, literally a decade later, that it really began to become active. And what they started doing was installing interpretive signs at a few dozen places around the province, many of these signs dealing with Manitoba's early fur trade and trading posts. Then, during the 60s, leading up to the Canadian centennial in 1967 and Manitoba's centenary in 1970, the board started putting emphasis on plaques that commemorated political and historical themes. You know, so for example, there were plaques on the boundaries of what was called the postage stamp province, when Manitoba was much smaller than it is today, as well as the origin of the name, Manitoba. Initially, those signs were made of wood, and of course, anybody who's put up plaques knows that wood is not good at resisting the elements. So eventually, the plaques were replaced by six-sided aluminum signs, many of which are still standing today. People have probably noticed these hexagonal signs, and what you probably have noticed if you've looked at one of them is that the language on them is unilingually English. Occasionally, if there was maybe a value in having French at a particular place, they would have a second plaque next to the English one in French. But basically, it was English pretty much everywhere.
And is the Historic Sites Preservation Act still in force today?
Well, in a manner of speaking, I suppose, yes. The original act was revised and expanded substantially in 1970. And by this time, the 1970s, the provincial government was becoming really active in the realm of managing historic resources. It formed a government group called the Historic Resources Branch to coordinate all aspects of the role of the provincial government in marking provincial history and heritage. It did all sorts of research, for example, about provincial history. The board was maintained by this new act, and the act, by the way, was called the Historic Sites and Objects Act. The board had a membership now, and this is again a quote from the act, of no fewer than five members. But the real changes in legislation and in the commemoration of historic sites didn't take place until the mid-1980s.
What happened then?
Well, in 1986, there was a new act. Again, they revised the original one, and this time they named it the Heritage Resources Act. Along with the change in the name of the act, they also changed the name of the board. It no longer was the Historic Sites Advisory Board. It now became the Manitoba Heritage Council, and it was defined as having not fewer than nine members. So it was getting a little bit bigger, and I suspect also more diverse in its composition. So, for example, its chair was a woman, Jean Friesen, a historian from the University of Manitoba, and the Heritage Council greatly expanded its commemorative mandate. So, for example, it included plaques for underrepresented groups such as women, labor, ethnic, and Indigenous heritage. Those older six-sided unilingual signs, well, they were abandoned. They're still out there in the landscape, but they didn't start putting any more of them up. And instead, they used plaques made of etched brass that were mounted on a wall or a white concrete podium. These new plaques, well, of course, they had to be fully bilingual. But in fact, even in a few cases, they were trilingual with languages like Ukrainian and sometimes Indigenous languages. Unfortunately, many of these newer plaques have not stood the test of time. They literally haven't weathered well. Some of the ones I've seen, for example, ones that are not protected from the sun, have turned almost jet black and are therefore almost illegible.
Now, you said before that the Manitoba Heritage Council still exists?
On paper, at least, yes. But the council has not met in over 7 years. Now, 8 months ago, it started to look hopeful. The government appointed 10 new members to the council. And in the name of full disclosure, I was one of those people. Unfortunately, I can report that this new council has had no meetings, and if one can extrapolate from this trend, my one-year term will end before any meeting is held. You know, that's too bad, I think, because, I guess it says that the Manitoba Heritage Council is just not seen by the provincial government as playing a useful role, and yet I think it has provided valuable service over its 77-year history, and I think it could continue to do so today if it was given an opportunity.
Well, fingers crossed. You might see one meeting. Gordon, thank you so much for this.
You're welcome.
What's up for next week?
We're going to talk about a Winnipeg institution that, by some accounts, was established in 1887 and which was supposedly the oldest of its kind in Canada and one of four oldest in the entire world. Now, whether or not these claims are valid, that institution is now gone. And next week, we will remember its legacy.
Gordon, thank you so much.
Talk next week. Bye-bye for now.
No matter where I go, every time the wind blows, puts me back in Manitoba. Many moons.